Thank you. Good evening and welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We've been listening to what I think is a particularly melodious and beautiful version of the mantras. Om Aim Rim Klim Chamundaye Viche. They don't sing Swaha, but we do and can. So, for the last few weeks, we have been looking into the power of Spanda as mantra, and as well into that aspect of Spanda that manifests as the energy within words and sounds, particularly in the Shakti mantras, Om Aim Rim Klim. And, of course, as inevitably happens when we practice with mantra, I had this experience this weekend. I was teaching at the Yoga Journal Conference in Colorado, and I did a class on mantra. And inevitably, invariably, people came up to me afterwards to talk about the stuff, the emotions that had been coming up during the practice, because it is one of the qualities of the liberating Spanda, especially when it manifests through mantra practice, to start to literally liberate the vasanas, the vikalpas, the emotions, you know, those complexes of thoughts and feelings that literally inhabit our subtle body, and which are the, you know, in so many ways, the veil, the screen through which we experience life. So in practicing with mantra, partly because it has this power to liberate the buried aspects of the psyche, and also partly because it is a form, you know, mantra is a form. It's an aspect of the formless Spanda that is, you know, consists of specific words and sounds. In other words, it consists of the uprising of the Matrika Shakti, of the vowels and consonants that actually create particular experience. And therefore, it just is the nature of mantra practice, as of all practices that have to do with the form, you know, the actually concentrating, focusing on something. It just brings up a lot of questions and a lot of inner experience and contradiction and doubt. And sometimes, not surprisingly, those inner experiences of transformation and purification are mirrored on the outside. They become enacted in our exterior life. So practicing with an enlivened mantra is going to, if we understand what's going on, it's going to give us a really powerful look at what's going on in our lives at any given moment, and also what it is that, let's say we've made a contract with ourselves in this life to move through, to purify, to allow to be transformed. So in just a moment, we're going to chant the mantras to the goddess Chamunda, and then the first verse of the Spanda Karikas, and then we're going to practice with three of the most significant verses in the Spanda Karikas, verses 28, 29, and 30, which are actually a description of the experience of an enlightened tantrika. And the verses go, everything arises out of the individual soul. This is verse 28. And so he is all things because he perceives his identity with the awareness he has of them. Very profound verse. Therefore, there is no state in thoughts, of words and their meanings that is not Shiva, that is not God, that is not pure consciousness. It is the enjoyer alone, that is Shiva, the divine experiencer, who always and everywhere abides in the object of enjoyment. And we'll talk more about that in some detail. It is the enjoyer alone who always and everywhere abides in the object of experience. So this verse not only describes the experience of a liberated being, it also contains a practice or an understanding about ourselves, which is in itself a practice for liberating consciousness. So it is a great verse. It's a great verse in the sense that it's actually held in very great esteem by practitioners of many, many different approaches to non-dual sadhana, the recognition that everything that you experience, even though it appears to be outside, is actually part and parcel of the experiencing consciousness that makes it all possible. That is a profoundly transforming understanding. So we'll get to that in a minute. And before we actually start the chant the mantras and start the class, I want to say that this coming week is the start of two sacred celebrations, both of them scheduled around the lunar cycle. And in my experience, lunar festivals, the festivals that are, you know, kind of scheduled according to the phases of the moon, are particularly powerful precisely because they are connected to the cycles of the year, which in the old traditions were always marked by festivals. And so these two festivals, the Jewish Holy Week that starts on Monday with Rosh Hashanah and culminates in Yom Kippur, and the Navaratri Festival, which is the one I want to talk a little bit about tonight, they are both really ancient festivals. They come from a time when human beings lived their lives according to the cycles of the year, cycles of the seasons, something that we don't necessarily practice today, but which is unbelievably significant because our bodies, as you know, our bodies and minds are so profoundly influenced by seasons, by the phases of the moon, that when we actually turn with our awareness into the cyclical changes, it really helps us align ourselves in ways that we may not ordinarily be aware of. And in my experience, this festival, the Navaratri Goddess Festival, is one of the opportunities that I always find allows me to enter into a very strong alignment with Goddess, with the different faces of the Goddess. And therefore, you know, because we always want blessings in our life, you know, we want the extra power that lets us experience the very best in ourselves and the very best in our lives. The Navaratri Festival is really all about experiencing blessing in different forms, experiencing the empowerments that are very much a part of tantric goddess practice. So I think it's a really great piece of synchronicity that we're doing Shakti Sadhana, Spanda Sadhana during this festival. Because what it means is that the Spanda practices that we'll be tapping into this coming week will be enhanced and imbued with sacred power by this time in the cycle. So Navaratri, as many of you know, means nine nights. It's a nighttime festival during which it's customary to celebrate a different face of the divine feminine, the sacred power, the Spanda Shakti. And I will be sending you a handout which contains some practices that you can work with if you want to celebrate this festival in a traditional way. But the chant that we've been practicing during this class is actually one of the main chants that's sung at Navaratri. Om Aim Hrim Klim Chamundaye Viche Swaha is chanted by priests, as again many of you know, during the fire rituals that are commonly practiced at Navaratri, And in the Navaratri fire rituals, they chant a 700-verse hymn called the Devi Mahatmyam, which describes the adventures of the goddess Durga in her battles with three sets of demonic forces, of dark forces. So this is a chant which celebrates the victory of light over darkness, which I think is a really helpful energetic chord to be tuning into at this particular chaotic time in our lives and in the life of the world. And the thing that the Navaratri festival and the song of the goddess Devi Mahatmyam literally means the triumph of the goddess. That the thing that this celebration reminds us of is that the light, the forces of light, are never defeated. That however difficult and dark the cycles of our personal lives and of the lives of the world may be, there always is a return of the light, a return of blessing that may take place as cycles change, but which is the fundamental arc of the universe. As Martin Luther King says, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. And that is what what this festival celebrates. So we are actually going to do some Navaratri practice next week. But I would just like to give you a little bit of the download on the Navaratri festival. And those of you who know this, and I know that there are some hardcore goddess practitioners here, so I ask your indulgence as I say some things that you may know already. There are actually two ways of, or two, you know, general ways in which this festival is celebrated, and how it's celebrated depends on which part of India you're from, or which what your family tradition is if you're Indian, or how your teacher celebrated it. One of the modes is to invoke 9 forms of the goddess Durga, who is the most popular form of the mother goddess in India, and she's celebrated as the maiden goddess, as the yogini. There are literally 9 names of the goddess. Each day of the festival is dedicated to one of her names. The other way to celebrate Navaratri, which is the way I celebrate it, is to divide the 9 days into three-day segments. And in the first day, we celebrate the face of goddess as Kali, the fierce one. The second series of 3 is celebrated in honor of Lakshmi, the power of abundance. And the third sequence of 3 is dedicated to Saraswati, goddess of subtle wisdom, learning, speech, and music. And all these faces are aspects of goddess Durga, who is, in fact, the iconographic form of the Spanda Shakti. Durga being the warrior goddess. But the Navaratri festival, though it celebrates these goddess faces, is in essence a festival about sadhana itself, especially if you practice it with the 3 faces, Kali, Lakshmi, and Saraswati. So Kali, in the first 3 nights, represents the purifying power within the mantra, the purifying power within the awakened kundalini, the energy of liberation, which always has to purify the veils and the different layers of veiling that all of us have accrued. So in the festival, the first 3 nights are all about purification. And the first 3 nights of the goddess festival can be both intense, in my experience also, quite ecstatic, because Kali is a particularly strong, ecstatic aspect of goddess. In the second 3 nights, the Lakshmi nights, we receive the gifts that the awakened Spanda Shakti opens to us as our psyche is purified, as our egoic forces in our nature are purified, we start to experience, you know, incredible small and large miracles of good fortune and love and the arising of good qualities that are one of the results, one of the gifts of Goddess Sadhana. And in the last three nights, the Saraswati nights, we experience the opening of insight and wisdom. And of course, these three aspects of Spanda Shakti, of the powers of liberation, don't necessarily always happen in sequence. You know, we experience them all at the same time often. But this particular approach to celebrating Goddess takes them in sequence. And I will be sending you links to some chants that you can do if you feel drawn to celebrating Navaratri. Or you can chant Om Aim Hrim Klim Chamundaye Vijay Swaha. And I would also suggest that you consider making an altar for the occasion, which can be very simple, a table with a cloth on it. You could put a picture or a statue of one of these goddesses on the altar, or all of them. Or you could place stones or crystals or a plant, or, you know, a picture of a feminine form that invokes the divine for you. And that altar can serve as a kind of a focal point for making intentions, saying prayers, for chanting, or just sitting for your meditation practice with the intention to tune in to the energy of this very powerful time, which will be alive and online in the universe during this 10 days. So, and as I say, in our next week's class, which will be taking place on the fifth day of the festival, which is one of the Lakshmi days, so we'll do a bit of Navaratri Mojo together. So let's take a big breath and let it out. And see if you can tune in to that force within your body and that force that's moving through the air that surrounds you, which is breathing life force into you. So you can center your awareness on the experience of opening your body to take in the breath, as though the breath is flowing in through your nostrils and your lungs, of course, but even more deeply through the pores of your body. Because in truth, that is how it is. We are being breathed and enlivened second by second by that force of Shakti, the Spanda Shakti, which is present in every particle of air, every particle of our bodies. So that with this awareness, the experience of breath becomes an experience of being breathed. And little by little, we can allow our bodies to open such that we can begin to feel how Spanda is creating life within us, through us and around us. And we'll chant the mantras dedicated to the multifaceted Spanda Shakti, the power of inspiration, the power of manifestation, the power of divine pleasure, that power which removes our obstacles, which cuts our obstacles. We'll chant five times, Om Aim Hrim Klim Chamundaye Vijay Swaha. And then follow that by chanting the first verse of the Spandakarikas three times. So with a breath, an inward breath fill yourself with the power of Spanda as the breath. Om Aim Rim Klim Chamundaye Viche Swaha. 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 And now we praise that Shankara, who is the source of the power of the Shaktis, by the opening and closing of whose eyes there is the dissolution and arising of the universe. Yasyonme shani me shabhyam jagata pralayodayau tam shakti chakra vibhava parabhavam shankaram stumaha. Yasyonme shani me shabhyam jagata pralayodayau tam shakti chakra vibhava parabhavam shankaram stumaha. Yasyonme shani me shabhyam jagata pralayodayau tam shakti chakra vibhava parabhavam shankaram stumaha. We praise that Shankara, who is the source of the power of the energies, the shaktis, by whose expansion and contraction the universe is absorbed and comes into being. And you can find a posture that's grounded and lifted, allowing the inhalation to deepen the connection of your sit bones with the seat, allowing the exhalation to draw the body upwards through the spinal column, and just allowing the breath to flow in this vertical way, inward, flowing down towards the base, outward, flowing up through the center of the body, through the crown. Begin to feel the mantra, Om Aim Rim Klim, flowing with the inhalation down towards the root, down towards the core of the belly. Allowing the breath to adjust itself to the rhythm of the mantra. Then with the exhalation, feel the breath rising through the center of the body, flowing up through the heart, up through the throat, to the center of the head, and out the crown. The mantra flows in, down to the root, It rises up from the root through the center of the body with the exhalation. If your breath doesn't feel long enough to hold the whole mantra, you can allow the inhalation to flow in with Om Aim, the exhalation to flow out with Rim Klim. Remembering to tune into the energy, the vibratory quality that links the syllables and the breath, which are both expressions of Spanda Shakti. This mantra invokes these particular qualities of the Divine Feminine and the forms of Goddess associated with them. And yet in its essence, this mantra, like the breath, is an expression of that primordial throb which flows into manifestation through forms, through words, through sounds, and which also carves the pathway back to the primal silence out of which sound emerges. So the more we can allow the breath to allow the mantra to reveal its pulsing quality, the more we align ourselves with Spanda Shakti herself, the power that vibrates in speech, in breath, arising and subsiding into the great silence. Om Aim Hrim Klim. Listen to the reverberation of the sound. and become aware of the fact that what you're hearing, what you're experiencing as sensation, what you're experiencing as thought, as perception, would not be possible if it were not for the awareness, the experience of existing and knowing you exist. Our verses tonight are pointing to that recognition. Everything arises out of the individual soul, which means out of your awareness. And so he is all things because he perceives his identity with the awareness he has of them. Therefore, there is no state in thoughts of words and their meanings, or to broaden that, of emotions and perceptions, that is not Shiva, is not the pure awareness that is at the heart of the universe. It is the enjoyer alone that is pure awareness itself. It is the enjoyer alone who always and everywhere abides as the object of enjoyment. One of the great teachings of the Spandakarikas, which, you know, we, those of you who've been with us throughout this process, have looked at and examined and contemplated, is this recognition that we, as, let's call it, ego-identified individuals, are not generating experience. That Shakti, this divine power, is generating experience. And the great paradox that this verse is saying is really that even though it's not you making your heart beat, it's not Sally making Sally's heart beat, you know, it's not Patricia making Patricia's heart beat or making the blood circulate in Jessica's veins, it's Shakti, it's this life force that is actually living our lives for us. I just read a piece by a surgeon who spoke about how disconcerting it is for her, she was a woman, while performing surgery, to realize how much of our human experience is automatic. In other words, when you look into the body as a surgeon, when you cut open the skin and, you know, see what's going on underneath, you see that pretty much everything that's keeping us alive is being done for us. You know, we're not managing the chemical interactions that control our metabolism, even though our thoughts and actions and diet, of course, affect them. But even our experience of inside and outside, of me and you, is a product of brain processes and also of the consciousness that is inside and beyond those brain processes. So we're not, in that sense, in the sense that we ordinarily think of as me, we're not the doers of our actions. And, of course, spiritual practice, and especially in the Eastern traditions, is all about getting that, recognizing that, and experiencing the freedom that comes from realizing that, you know, you, that is that in you which tends to identify with the body-mind, is actually not in charge. And yet what the sages and what this text is pointing out is this sort of absolute non-dual recognition that deeper source, that primal vibration that begins as a subtle throb in the infinite stillness of consciousness vibrating worlds into existence, is actually not different from our own deepest consciousness. So the most primal and radical point of the non-dual tradition is that we are the doers of our life, not just our individual life, but of the, all the lives in all the world, and that when we can begin to identify with first our own awareness, our own, that, you know, that that knowing beingness that is the deepest part of our individuality that most of us can experience with our eyes open and our consciousness awake, when we begin to identify with our own awareness and actually follow it into its own depths, whether we do it through direct path consciousness, looking into our own consciousness, or through following the breadcrumb trail of the breath, or through allowing the vibratory power within mantra to carry us down into the depths of the para level of vibratory sound. What this practice will ultimately show us is that everything is arising from our own consciousness, which the tantras tell us is not different than the consciousness of the Absolute. Even though our experience of consciousness may be limited, it constantly contains the potential for expanding and showing us that everything is inside us. And there are, of course, enormous implications for this in our daily life, as you very well know. So the self in us is not different from the self of the universe, bottom line of the Spandakarikas. And these verses 28 and 29 and 30, which describe the actual experience of an enlightened tantrika, are, of course, pointing to the state which is the attainment of the tradition. It's you know, tantra claims that the reason that non-dual tantra claims to be the ultimate path, the highest experience, is because it points to an enlightenment in which we recognize the oneness of our individual awareness with the great awareness that creates all this. And ultimately, the tantric sage, the enlightened tantrika, actually recognizes that his or her powers are not different than the powers of the Absolute. And in other words, tantric enlightenment is an empowered enlightenment. It's not just a passive witnessing experience of, okay, my awareness is different than my body and I can be free by being the witness of my body-mind. That is certainly a stage in the process. But the tantric enlightenment says that, you know, my awareness is not just a witness. It actually holds it all, and not just my own experience, although of course, we start with our own experience. Eventually, as we continue this practice, we will start to realize that all of the worlds are inside us. And I know some of you have had tastes of this. I've had a couple myself. It's fairly awe-inspiring, and if you're not ready for it, a little scary, to say the least. But it is actually the truth. And as we tune into the gift, the empowerment that this text and this tradition wants to give us, this truth becomes more and more present in our experience, more and more intimate in our experience, and more an avenue into freedom. So I want to just say something about the, you know, one of the kind of main triads or trinities that Eastern philosophy has to do with, you know, that it's the recognition that there are three sort of distinct layers in our experience, and we normally experience them as separate. This is Eastern Philosophy 101. So according to the text of especially Hinduism and Buddhism, these layers are described as the knower, the known, and the process of knowing, or the subject, the object, and the process of perceiving. There's me, the perceiver, who we believe inhabits this body, who's inside our skin. There's you, who's the object of my perception, or, you know, of course, I'm the object of your perception, or that is, Sally is the object of Karen's perception. And then there's the experience of knowing and perceiving, which connects us, which is a kind of stream of subtle interactivity that we experience without necessarily being aware that we're experiencing it, as a current flowing between us, between the subject, the subjective self, and the objects of experience. And so these three aspects of experience are the subject, the object, and the process of knowing, the connection. And, of course, in our ordinary experience, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, are experienced as seeing something out here. You know, I'm seeing, in my case, as I sit here talking to you, I'm seeing the phone, I'm seeing my computer, I'm seeing the top of the desk, I'm seeing the paper with my notes on it. And, you know, you have your own object of vision and your objects of hearing, which is the sound of this voice. And what's connecting us is the experience of knowing, of perceiving, of hearingness, of seeingness. And one of the things that always excites me about being in a virtual sangam like this is that the connection of the process of hearing each other, of tuning into each other over the airwaves, over the, you know, the fiber optic cables, which are, you know, giving us the ability to touch each other energetically despite time and distance, is that we are actually kind of pickled in, cooked in those connections, the connections between subject and object. So what the tradition says is that it's the shared consciousness, that is the subtle awareing that every living being shares, you know, including trees and you know, apparently rocks and air and, you know, dirt and the core of the planet, all share this consciousness. And it's the fact that we as mammals, for example, we as living, moving, sentient beings share consciousness, that we're able to understand each other. So in all the ways that we communicate, the capacity to communicate is the source of shared consciousness. So this is really the central tenet of the tradition, and the understanding is that it's that shared consciousness, or that property, that quality of existence, which is both conscious of objects, you know, what we think of as objects, and conscious of itself, conscious of the fact that we are conscious. That is the way in which Shiva Shakti, the absolute living face of being, is constantly expressing itself in all that is. So I want to quote a line from Alexis Sanderson, one of the great scholars of Shaiva Tantra. And this is how he describes the essence of this philosophy. He says, "This is a philosophy which celebrates the absolute autonomy of a non-individual consciousness, which alone exists, containing the whole of reality within the bliss of a dynamic I-ness," that is I, you know, I, not E-Y-E, but I, "projecting space, time, and interrelating fluxes of subjective and objective phenomena as its content and form, manifesting itself in this spontaneous extroversion through the powers of will, natural spontaneous cognition, and activity as the three radical modes of infinite power. So, in other words, all expressions of will or impulse, of knowing and of activity are powers or expressions of this great I consciousness, this which, you know, I've always liked to call the big I. And these powers and their subsidiary powers run through all of life as this active intelligence that manifests everything from the mega forces of the physical world, like gravity, which we could say is powered by the divine will that intends for this planet that we live on to be experienced in a relatively high state of density and weight, the impulse that sprouts as plants and acts through the brain and nervous system and circulates blood, and which even when we're sleeping and not thinking, they're operating to keep our hearts beating, our breath flowing, to intelligently recognize when a cell needs to die or when a bacteria needs to mutate in order to avoid being killed by antibiotics. They're all driven by this instinctive will to live, this instinctive knowing of how to do it, and the activities, whether they're biochemical, hormonal, neurological, that are the action of that, you know, those primal powers of consciousness. So all of us are always living as expressions of will, knowing, and acting. And the enlightened being, recognizing this truth about her life, intuits that her individual will, your individual will, is an expression of divine will. In other words, there really isn't a separation between my will and thy will, even though it feels like that sometimes. Our actions are expressions of the activity of divine action. Our cognition is an expression of divine cognition. So the Spandakarikas really offers us a series of ways of understanding. In Buddhism, it's called the view, you know, the way of looking at things, that allows us to at least acknowledge as a kind of a bottom line this amazing possibility that each of us is an individual expression of this single, autonomous, non-individual, non-localized consciousness, which nonetheless is expressing itself as your individual consciousness, my individual consciousness. It's really, you know, kind of extraordinarily mind-blowing as we learn to relax and stop tightening in order to preserve a sense of separation, to begin to contact that inner impulse of Spanda, of constant creative aliveness that's orchestrating, moving through our awareness, that's moving through our breath, that's vibrating through the sounds we make. And we learn to consciously align with it, and we learn to let ourselves be carried, to flow with reality. Understanding that reality, Spanda Shakti, will carry us, and that we can relax and let that happen and allow ourselves to be guided by it. And that's when our life becomes miraculous, even when it feels like a struggle. So everything arises out of the individual soul. And so he is all things because he perceives his identity with the awareness he has of them. Therefore, there is no state in thoughts or words and their meanings that is not Shiva. It is the enjoyer alone. who always and everywhere abides as the object of enjoyment. It is the enjoyer alone who always and everywhere abides as the object of enjoyment. So let's just take a moment to investigate that. I want to give you some, sometimes they're called pointing out instructions. So just recognize for a moment. Well, start by feeling the breath flowing. Feeling that the breath just is naturally flowing in and out of the body-mind. You don't have to breathe. Breath is breathing you. Shakti is manifesting as your breath. Now, just for a moment, as you feel into the sensation of the breath flowing, as you feel into the experience of sensation in your muscles, sensation is a tingle in your face, sensation is the, in my case, slight irritation in the throat, sensation as the touch of the air against your skin, clothes, the little itch in your neck, the slight ache in your lower back, touching into the experience of sensation, the thoughts arising and subsiding. Be aware that all of this experience is only possible because there is an underlying overall awareness a consciousness a capacity for experiencing that is present to all this and that has this quality of presence. That vibrates with presence, with knowingness, with a sense of being. So just let yourself tune into that awareing that is holding your experience. That is really, even though it's so often hidden, is your primary experience. In order to know anything, in order to experience anything, you have to have this experience of being, of I am-ness. And the only way you can experience I am-ness, existence, is to have this intrinsic capacity for being present and aware. So it is this presence of awareness of your existence that knows itself, and that's our most ordinary and intimate experience. It's always present. So the idea that there is a mind that exists independent of thinking or a world independent of perceiving is something that we take for granted, something that we believe is the case, but which actually is a belief, which actually is a concept. So if you really look deeply into your experience, even the sensation of touching the floor or the sensation of being tickled in your body or the sensation of the impact of a thought or a feeling, even the experience of a so-called material world that seems to be outside us is actually only possible because of this aware presence that is the background of all your experience, and which, in fact, contains your experience. So, as the verse says, everything that you experience, whether it seems to be inside you or outside you, is arising inside your experience. It pervades all experience. And even though we're sensing or perceiving the material world outside ourselves, even though we're experiencing ourselves as one of the people in this world of separate others and interacting with this world with the understanding that to achieve anything, to do anything, I have to act, make relationships, do things interactively with people and things outside me, what the tradition says is that is never actually happening. And I find this so extraordinary to contemplate. And it's one of the deep truths of the Spandakarikas that the concepts and beliefs that keep us thinking, assuming, taking for granted that I am confined to this body and that everything else is outside me, which, as we looked at in our first class, actually arise from the words and thoughts that the Machaka Shakti, the power of language, creates in us. Even though this understanding that there's me here and you out there is so core to our lives, it's the basis of everything we think and feel and do in this world, the truth is that even with all the exhaustive biological investigations that have gone on in the last 100 years or so, no matter how much biologists and neurologists examine the process of perception, no one has ever been able to prove that the material world is real as such, or that it actually exists outside us. In other words, the brain, the human perceptual apparatus, offers no proof that the outside world really exists. I mean, what we know about the process of perception is that the brain receives signals that describe the state of the body's chemical interactions, temperature, etc. That information registers along the neural pathway. It all happens as electrochemical bursts that run up and down the network of nerve cells. And when the signal reaches the brain, the cerebral cortex arranges it in a pattern that we perceive as reality. But the truth is that the brain is not really letting us know anything about how it's processing this and how accurate it is. We only get the picture that the cerebral cortex gives us. There is no direct connection between the raw data that the body is collecting and what's happening outside us. We don't know where it comes from, which, and this is just, you know, true on the physical level. And despite the fact that we can measure what happens in the brain during thinking and perceiving, you know, which we certainly can, we've learned to measure brain states and brain waves and, you know, and how different areas of the brain become active during different processes. Nonetheless, neuroscientists have not yet found the mechanism by which physical processes in the brain produce thoughts, perceptions, and memory. I mean, we can see that neurons fire together in different parts of the brain while we're thinking. But scientists have not been able to find that part of the brain that produces consciousness or even thoughts, which is kind of remarkable considering that a lot of neuroscientists will tell us that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of neurons firing in the brain, just as, grade school Newtonian physics gives us laws of, the properties of matter. And we live and act as though matter is solid. Whereas, in fact, quantum physics, which in many ways is way beyond, psychology and neuroscience, continues to tell us that at the heart of matter there is no solidity. There is simply dancing particles that constantly shift and change. So we really don't know if the world is inside or outside. And if any of you have ever gone into a state of deep meditation where it becomes clear to you that what we think of, what we imagine to be outside, is actually arising and subsiding inside our own consciousness. Have you ever had that experience? I've had that experience a few times. It's very surprising, and yet it feels completely normal. And when you have that expansion of consciousness in meditation and you recognize that the body, all the other bodies, all the objects in the room are actually constantly dissolving into and arising out of this consciousness, this awareness that is everything and that is you, and that essentially consciousness is alone in the universe. Everything in this universe is not just intimate with every other thing, it's constantly arising and subsiding in that which underlies everything. Just the way thoughts arise and subside in your mind. So when the neuroscientist Albert Korbinsky wrote in the 1930s, "The map is not the territory," that famous phrase, "the map is not the territory," what he was saying is that the picture created in the cortex by the interactions of hormones and neurons, etc., does not necessarily correspond to the actual source of the data that produces it. In other words, for all we know, the outside world that we experience could be a dream, just like the dreams we experience when we're asleep. And of course, Buddhism famously tells us that it is a dream. That, that this world that seems so solid is actually no more solid than the world we experience in a dream during sleep, which, if it's a really, if we're a normal person and dreaming of a city or an object or anything else, in that dream state, it feels completely real. So, one thing that neuroscience has seen is that the brain uses the same apparatus to perceive the so-called waking world and the so-called dream world. It's the cortex at the rear of the skull that lets us see an inner image. And as far as neurologists can determine, it's the shift between where in the brain that stimulation takes place that allows us to distinguish between a solid object, a liquid object, a fantasy, and a dream. But no matter whether we're dealing with an inner object, a mantra or a fantasy, or one that we believe is outside us, there is no single pattern that distinguishes the so-called real world from the fantasy world. There's just a lot of electrochemical activity that takes the shape of trees, clouds, human bodies. So the brain is literally manufacturing the world for each of us. The tree seems solid because our brain registers a bunch of electrical signals as touch. Light seems to come into the room because our brain registers a bunch of signals as light. And the light can equally well be experienced as inside as anybody who's ever had a, you know, a meditation experience of light can tell you. When you're with your eyes closed in a dark room, when you're in a, you know, in a an inner state of awareness, there are lights that are, as you know, as the sages tell us, brighter than, not only brighter than the sun, brighter than a million suns. So the sages saw that, or we could say realized, these truths about reality. That's how all these teachings came to us. They didn't have microscopes or telescopes or, you know, chemistry, so they had their own way of perceiving this, which was through meditation, through revelation. And they described what, you know, what we call, which we would call neural impulses, etc. They called subtle organs. So they, the sages, the texts of the traditions describe how in the inner world there are colors and tastes and sounds and subtle organs of perception which act through the physical organs and which are equally capable of seeing inner images, hearing inner sounds, experiencing lights when the eyes and ears are shut, are closed. And they saw in meditation how images and sounds and people and landscapes arise entirely inside the mind with no connection to the outer world. So what they came to realize is that there are levels of experience in which clearly perception is not connected to anything outside. And they posited that the same process could be at play when we are interacting with what we consider the outer world. So one of the great texts of Mahayana Buddhism, non-dual Buddhism, says, nothing is as it seems, nor is it otherwise. In other words, if we really understand what is happening in our processes of perception, we can start to feel this absolutely extraordinary fact that though there obviously sense this reality, which, you know, a number of us who don't have brain abnormalities experience in more or less the same way, it's also true and very deeply true that we cannot experience this consensus reality except inside our own awareness. So, in a certain sense, we never really know if the way we're experiencing the world that we see and touch and interact through is actually real. And if the way we experience, for example, relationships is objectively the case, because the more we understand our inner processes, the more we begin to realize that everything that we experience is constantly being filtered through our conceptual frame. My experience of the same situation may not be the same as your experience, even though we are sharing in a consensus reality. So there is this amazing paradox that nothing is as it seems, nor is it otherwise. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Everything arises from the individual soul. So he is all things because he perceives his identity with the awareness that he has of them. The enlightened being, which is you sometimes, and hopefully will be all of us, all the time at some point. What we experience is first that nothing can be known outside of awareness. That everything we experience is actually being experienced inside awareness. So insofar as we recognize that all of our experience is occurring, is rising and subsiding inside this field of pulsating energy and knowingness that we call awareness, everything is happening inside. Everything is being experienced inside of awareness. And from a metaphysical point of view, as we experience it in our deep, as we become more and more connected to the truth of awareness, of what awareness is, the great consciousness known as Shiva Shakti, or Shiva Spanda, or Chit Ananda, awareness, blissfulness, is processing your experience through the apparatus of your brain and body and mind. Consciousness is experiencing itself as a world, but none of that world that it is experiencing is outside itself. So when we're trying to understand this truth from our limited perspective, it's very useful to think of the manifestation of so-called physical reality as happening the way thoughts arise and subside inside your individual field of consciousness. But what this verse is saying is that that's a good way of understanding it when we're in a limited state. But the truth is, even what we consider the physical world is rising and subsiding inside consciousness, inside your individual consciousness, which is not different from the great consciousness that we call Shiva Shakti. Everything arises out of the individual soul. So he is all things because he perceives his identity with the awareness he has of them. It is the enjoyer alone who always and everywhere abides as the object of enjoyment. So there is nothing, nothing that arises as words and thoughts and their meaning, which is not identical with Shiva. So let's process this. You can find a posture that feels comfortable and upright. And if you've fallen into a deep trance state, just listen to my voice and these words from within that trance state. With your eyes open, be aware of the objects that you experience in the place you're sitting or standing or lying. Be aware of what you see. The vision is the most differentiating part of our apparatus. Be aware of what you experience as sensation, both inside the body and around. Be aware of the ways in which thoughts and perceptions are arising and actually taking the form of your experience. In other words, whatever you see, hear, touch, think, smell is actually your consciousness taking the shape of what you're experiencing. And recognize in a great leap of attentiveness that all of this that you're experiencing, even with your eyes open, is being held inside this vibrant, profoundly intelligent suchness that we call awareness, which is your capacity, our capacity, because it's not different in you than it is in me, because you and me on this level are not different. There is one consciousness that is making it possible for this person, Casey, or this person who calls herself Jamie, or who calls himself Aaron. There is this awareness that is holding experience in this moment, pervading everything that you experience. So just see, let your eyes fall shut, fall closed, and see if you can just allow awareness to recognize itself. Breath is flowing, and it's awareness which allows the experience of breath flowing. Sensation is happening, and it's awareness which allows the experience of sensation happening. There's an experience of I-ness, of me-ness, which is arising inside awareness and giving you the deep conditioned impression that there's a separate limited me and everything else that's it being outside, being not me. See if you can recognize the way in which this knowingness is aware of sensations, of thoughts, including the thought, I'm me. That too is arising inside awareness. And if thoughts are arising and you're thinking, I'm not getting this or this is confusing, see if you can become aware of that knowingness which is present to the thoughts. And see if you can, even for a moment, recognize that you in your deepest core are this awareing, this witnessing. So rather than noticing that part of you which seems to stand aside from thoughts and see them or witness them, see if you can just surrender into recognizing awareness. Not only being aware of, but literally holding and permeating everything that you're experiencing. See if you can feel the seamlessness of experience. Again, it's easier to do this with your eyes closed. This voice is actually arising and subsiding inside awareness. Your awareness that you identify as my awareness that I identify as my awareness. But if you really tune into that which is holding and knowing experience, it really is all arising and subsiding inside that sense of being or existingness, which is not actually, this is the big amazing thing, which is actually not local. It's actually not just inside your body or inside my body. It's present everywhere. I want to quote from a teaching on this from Rupert Spira, who's a very beautiful non-dual teacher, which in his words, it describes this phenomena. All that is known is experiencing and experience. All that is known is experiencing. And experiencing is not divided into one part, an inside self that experiences, and another part, an outside object, other or world, that is experienced. Experiencing is seamless and intimate, made of knowing or awareness alone. This intimacy, in which there is no room for selves, objects, or others, is love itself. It lies at the heart of all experience, completely available under all circumstances. Everything arises from the individual soul, so he is all things because he perceives his identity with the awareness he has of them. It is the enjoyer alone, the experiencer alone, who always and everywhere abides as the object of experience. Therefore, there is no thought, word, or object that is not Shiva, that is not consciousness, that is not pure awareness. So, you can open your eyes if you like, and this would be a good moment to talk about this. In other words, to share what happened as we went through this process, or share any questions that you have or comments that you have about the process, the insights or whatever that arose. So if you have something you would like to say, You can press star 2 to raise your hand. Star 7, sorry. Deb just sent me a message saying star 7. And she will call you, this will raise your hand and she'll call on you, and then you can speak into this shared consciousness, which is your consciousness and my consciousness. I'm seeing two hands raised. Deb, Jane and Christine. So Deb, you choose who gets this. Oh, Christine, you're first. Hi.
Hi, Sally. I don't want to belabor this at all. It's a kind of a quick question. When when experiencing this that you just opened up to us, my own senses or perceiving consciousness gets really mergy. And so I'm wanting, I'm getting a headache even trying to talk about this. Do you have any suggestions for that? Do I stay open and receptive or go more global, or it's kind of not fun right here? And I can pull off it really fast, but I don't want to.
So when you say it's uncomfortable, does that mean that you feel too many consciousnesses inside yours? Is that a good way of describing it? Or is it uncomfortable? Is it a feeling of pressure?
It's a feeling of it's big.
Uh-huh.
And then it's my consciousness wanting to close down, and like it's hard right now because it's nighttime. When it's daytime, it's easier because I can span out and expand, and it's hard right now. It's kind of dark in here. But
I would suggest if that's the case that you turn on a light and just let yourself encompass the objects that you see with your physical eyes in that awareness.
I will play with that. Thank you.
And the other thing, the thing that I do when it feels uncomfortable, when consciousness is expansive and it feels uncomfortable, is I actually let it expand more.
That's the kind of pointer I wanted. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Because it's
wanting,
it's starting to track down.
Let it expand more.
That's kind of scary. Okay, thank
okay,
you.
Okay, so let it expand more. It just wants some space, so to speak. Consciousness wants some space. And our conditioning, which everybody, of course, has, our conditioning wants to contract it. So, in other words, the Machaka Shakti wants to condense it and contract it. So
that's it.
Okay. Good. Okay. Widen. Thank you so much, Christine. I'm sure that question was one that others had as well. So Jane.
I really appreciate the way you explain things. It's very clarifying. For me, what was really different was, or amazing, was when you coached us to actually notice how awareness was taking the shape of the objects in perception, that it happened for me, and that's never happened quite like that before. So that was quite, it was really cool. And I really appreciate how you were explaining awareness as this seamless flow as love. And it also kind of brings to mind a little bit an experience that I had not long ago where I was working with a teacher, and I realized that I didn't have any thoughts, but my attitude, the actual attitude I was taking, was not allowing me to truly notice that continuum of experience back and forth. And I noticed, I was able to see that I was actually projecting things out. So it's a tricky thing to talk about and to work with. And I just appreciate how you are so clear in explaining it and leading us to these places that are hard to get to. So thank you very much, Sally.
Well, thank you for sharing that experience. I totally, understand what you're saying, and I think we all do that it's not even thoughts that does this. It's the the undercurrent projection of attitude, and you know, in Sanskrit it's called the bhava, which means attitude. And my guru used to say that our fundamental bhava, contracted bhava, which is again, it's the result of the outgoing separative aspect of shakti, of spanda, that the bhava that we're a human being, you know, that we have this particular identity which is so deeply rooted, and then the various attitudes that our conditioning creates for us, such as, you know, the attitudes that make us feel close to some people and, you know, judge others, et cetera, et cetera. And that work that you're talking about of just letting yourself recognize that your consciousness encompasses, holds all these feelings, including the uncomfortable ones, is really incredibly liberating, because it spares you the trouble of having to go, okay, I should have a better attitude, because Shakti is manifesting as even the most uncomfortable attitude. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.
So we have a caller from Asheville, whom Deb is about to unmute. So can you tell us your name?
It's Gail.
Hi, Gail.
Hi.
Gail, hi.
Yeah. I had an interesting experience. As you were talking, I was guided to place myself in different people that I know.
Cool.
And feel what it feels like from their perspective almost. And I even asked permission to place myself in you and feel the lightness. It was very light and sparkly. And it just was interesting, in the sense that we're all one, to feel, well, what does that feel like? And then at the end, I was guided to place myself in Shiva. And then I also invited in the goddess, you know, Shakti, and to feel what that felt like with the two of them, it just felt good. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
It just was a good experience to feel kind of the expansiveness of that we really are all one, and what it feels like from that perspective.
Yeah, that's very beautiful, and it's actually a great practice, and actually very useful in daily life to let yourself experience life from another person's perspective. And especially as you learn to do this in a way that doesn't feel invasive to the other person, which I feel that you get very clearly. It's a way of interacting with others that allows you to move past culture and move past judgment and actually start to recognize the fact that we are really all part of a seamless whole, even though we may have very different perspectives from the point of view of the mind and from the point of view of culture. I just want to share something that, you know, in the atmosphere of these days, probably a lot of you watched the debate or at least read the coverage about it. And depending on your perspective and your, you know, who you're rooting for, you had various emotional reactions. And one of my friends, who is a very, very committed, you know, member of the Democratic Party and a supporter of Hillary Clinton, and has a kind of a let's call it negative attitude towards Donald Trump, said that she was doing a practice very much like this while she was watching him, and she found herself really seeing the world from his perspective, feeling, you know, what it felt to her like he felt. And she said that she experienced from being within him, she experienced love for him. You know, that's just that kind of natural intimacy that we can feel when we're taking the perspective of another. So it's a very, very profound practice, Gail, and thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
So whether we accurately gauge another person's perspective by tuning into them, you know, because we can't always understand what's going through another person's mind. Nonetheless, as we really make a point of intimately tuning into the sense that the consciousness in me is the consciousness in another person, we do begin to experience a kind of natural, unattached lovingness, which is the result of feeling the same consciousness is in me as in this other person. So another point that I want to make, which really arises out of what Gail said, you know, is that one of the big points that Tantra, non-dual Tantra makes about consciousness is that it's inherently creative, which means that our consciousness, you know, our consciousness or our experience of consciousness is inherently creative. So, you know, consciousness is constantly creating perspectives and experiences and bhavas inside us. And so when we start to tune into the direct experience of our own awareness, what we also start to tune into is that inherent creativity. And in that way that may be small and subtle at first, and which in the enlightened being becomes huge and actually not at all subtle, is we start to experience the intrinsic powers within consciousness. So the expanded awareness that allows us to see that even though from one perspective we're cells in the body or thoughts in the mind of the great presence, that our individual consciousness is arising inside that great consciousness, the more we tune into it, the more it begins to be a reality that your awareness is not different than the great awareness. And it's not an understanding or recognition is meant to inflate us, you know, or to make us want to exercise our superpower, our inherent superpowers. And yet, we do have, as consciousness, we have these inherent superpowers. We have this endless creativity that we can begin to experiment with, to play with. And, of course, that's when we have these experiences of ourselves as artists of reality, you know, what the Course in Miracles calls the life of miracles, that starts to happen kind of naturally as we become more and more identified with consciousness. So that's why the beginning of Tantric awakening is the recognition that our true being is awareness, and also that little sort of switch, you know, where we begin to identify as awareness. You know, in a lot of the time in classical witness practice, we start to recognize that there is a witness. There's a knowingness that sees the mind and sees the ego. And, you know, often when that part of us sees us and sees, you know, the weird contortions that the average human mind goes through, there's a sense of judgment about it or a sense of separation from the self that arises. So the trick is to keep identifying yourself as awareness so that you begin to experience that seamlessness and that natural expansion and the way in which the creativity in consciousness is constantly, you know, wanting to create a, let's just call it a more expanded experience of yourself, so that, you know, we can start to recognize that even though there is this, you know, egoistic mechanism that is constantly going, I am like this, and this is mine, and this is not mine. You know, and with all the masses of vasanas that we create the experience of being a separate self, you know, this mechanism of individuality is constantly veiling the truth. But if we can keep coming back to the view, and which is one of the things I want to ask you to do, all of us to do this week, to just keep coming back to this thought, everything arises in the individual soul, out of the individual soul. So all of this that's arising and subsiding inside my experience is not just my experience. It's the reality of everything that I can be aware of is arising and subsiding inside consciousness, which is my consciousness, but which is also the consciousness. So the experiences that so many of you are having, not necessarily all the time, but, you know, but quite a bit of the time, of intuitions arising and feeling that, you know, there's a seam of joy that is present even when things aren't going well, creative capacities, shifts in vision, from some of you healing skills, all these experiences of you know, what some people call superpowers or siddhi that starts to arise in us as we identify with consciousness. These are glimpses, intimations of the truth of ourselves, which is that as we become more and more able to let go of identification with the separate self and its agendas, you know, as we begin to be able to see that egoic consciousness, that egoic self, as one more subtle thing that's arising and subsiding inside the great consciousness, you know, as we begin to relax into being consciousness itself, not having to seize on aspects of experience as mine and push away other aspects of experience as not mine, that expansion that Christine was talking about just starts to happen very, very naturally, very easily. And, you know, those crazy, miraculous powers that enlightened beings, certain kinds of enlightened beings manifest, are actually the result of having so completely, let's call it, died as an ego into the great consciousness, such that there is no sense of separation between your consciousness and Shiva's consciousness. And these manifestations of gracefulness, of graceful transformation, happen not because, you know, you as a, you know, or these beings, you know, as individuals, give blessings in deliberate ways out of their own power. It's that by having really, really understood that consciousness is never separate, these kind of miraculous expansions start to happen spontaneously and automatically. You know, when I was with my guru, there were so many things that happened in people's lives that just felt like miracles, you know, big stuff and small stuff, rescues that came at the last minute, cures of diseases, money coming when needed, creative flowering, things that you wanted, you know, that you secretly wanted or overtly wanted just coming to you. And we all thought that it was him, you know, that he was, you know, somehow he was, you could pray to him or you could pray to his guru and, you know, these things would come as a result of prayer. But in fact, he had nothing to do with it, and he would always say that. It had nothing to do with him or his will or his powers, that it was because his connection with the great source, with Shiva, that because his consciousness was merged in that consciousness, when you came into the field, the power of grace, the power of the Shiva Shakti that transcends karma would come into operation, and there would be these experiences of, actually being able to bend the seams of reality. I could tell you lots of stories. One of my favorites was I was once given a traffic ticket because I had inadvertently gone through. I had made a left turn on a very complicated intersection in the Bronx in New York City, which turned out to have been a traffic violation. And I, not wanting to get points on my license, I actually hired a lawyer, one of those lawyers that advertises on billboards, and I went to traffic court, and I was in court literally praying to my guru's guru to save me from this traffic ticket, which is sort of an embarrassing thing to admit. But as I was watching, I saw that there were 10 people before me who had all made this same mistake at this intersection, and the cop who was, who had appeared with them was reading their violation, and the judge would hear the violation, and the person would give their defense, which was the same one as mine. I had no idea that this, that the green arrow didn't mean it was okay to make a left turn. And the judge would just say, okay, guilty, and, slap the penalties on them. And I'm thinking, this is hopeless. I'm never going to, this is a done deal. I got up in front of the judge, and the cop started looking for the papers that contained his copy of my summons, and he couldn't find it. In other words, he lost the papers, so the judge had to dismiss my case. And that's like a silly little thing, but I can't tell you what a miracle it seemed to me that I was not going to be cited for. It was actually two traffic violations, which would have been 2 points on my license. And life under the umbrella of expanded consciousness is full of these, seemingly meaningless little miracles. And the deeper ones, where you start to recognize what it is that is exactly tying down your consciousness, and to be able, through the power of consciousness itself, to let go of those aspects of your self-identification which have throughout your life created suffering. So this paradox in the Spanda teaching is that when we truly recognize our awareness as the source of everything, we can simultaneously recognize that as individual consciousnesses, we are actually non-existent. We are simply a part of that great consciousness. And at the same time, we can recognize how supremely significant and divine and powerful this individual consciousness really is. So that is the great paradox of the expansion of consciousness. You recognize that you don't exist. You are a manifestation of Shiva Shakti, of Spanda, dancing in this particular form, body form. And then you recognize that this tiny, limited individual consciousness is actually the source of all of it. Everything arises from the individual soul. And he, she is all things because of the awareness that he has of them. It is the experiencer alone, that is the consciousness, that is the true self, who always and everywhere abides as the object of experience. So there is nothing in your experience that is different from Shiva, that is different from Shakti. Your awareness, which we can all just relax back into the experience of beingness, of awareness that is the background of everything that is arising and subsiding in the mind. So your awareing holds my voice is appearing only because awareness is able to hold it. The subtle presence of this telesangam is held in your awareness. So here's the mantra, here's the thought. And just hold this enlightened thought and feel how it feels if you just allow it to be the dominant thought. Everything is within me. Everything is within my awareness. Everything is arising inside this scintillating, vibrating presence filled with innate knowing, this pure beingness that is the reality of myself. And even if it feels to me at this moment that that awareing is contained within the body, let yourself recognize that the body is actually contained within awareness, within that which you experience as your awareness, your capacity for experiencing, your experience itself, your body, your name, your personal history, your past, your future, are simply thoughts appearing inside this awareing. Now, just for fun, with the understanding that your awareness contains the entire body of experience, bring to mind someone who attracts you, someone you love, a person, a place, an animal, and just to have this thought, this person, this place, this animal, this being that I love is within me. The experience of loving and the object of love is inside, is part of my awareness, is me. And let yourself feel that absolute identity between your experience of this being you feel affection for or attraction to, or simply familiarity with. Feel how this being, your entire experience of this being, is only possible, is only experienceable because consciousness, which is you, holds that being within itself. It's all within you. And now, of course, just for fun, we'll practice with the opposite. Bring to mind an image of something or someone that disturbs you, that you dislike, or that feels unpleasant or scary. And just have this same recognition. This is part of my consciousness. This is within me. This is an image or a thought or an experience held inside consciousness itself. just the way when you have a dream at night and you find yourself facing a dream lover or a bear or being yelled at by an authority figure or moving through a strange city. And when you wake up, you realize that this whole dream took place inside your consciousness. And that whatever appeared in your dream should be understood as a part of you. Expand that understanding to recognize that even the experiences of the waking world are possible only because your consciousness, your awareness, is able to hold them. There is no state, whether in thoughts, words, or objects, which is not pure consciousness, which is not Shiva. It is the experiencer alone who abides as the object of experience. So as the breath flows in and flows out, as you allow the body-mind to settle into this recognition, all experience takes place inside the experiencer, inside me, inside the awareness that is not different from the great awareness. Just let yourself be that. Whatever comes up, sensations, thoughts, feelings, emotions, let yourself relax into the awareness that is both the substratum of all that you experience, and which is the ground of being itself. With a great tuning into the breath that breathes you, that is arising and subsiding inside your own consciousness, just as the body appears and disappears inside consciousness. We'll end the call with this collective thought, I am. Consciousness appears as the experience of my existence. I am. All this appears within me. And that awareness, which is the true me, is the very awareness in which all this, positive and negative, difficult and easy, all this arises and subsides within consciousness, which is me. Have a beautiful evening and a beautiful week. And please send into the listserv whatever arises for you as a result of this contemplation. And do take some time to look at verses 28, 29, and 30. Everything arises out of the individual soul. So he is all things because he perceives his identity with the awareness he has of them. It is the experiencer alone who always and everywhere abides as the object of experience. Therefore, there is no state, no word, no thought that is not arising and subsiding in pure consciousness, that is not Shiva Shakti in this form. Namaste. Happy Shivaratri. I love you.